Now it's time for the Dave Congleton Show. News Talk 920 and FM 96.5 KVC.
You know what? It's not time. You know what we're missing over here?
What do we got?
We have no arrow.
The arrow's not working?
Arrow's not working.
I'm coming in.
All right. Meanwhile, we're just going to start off the show. Good afternoon and welcome to another edition of Hometown Radio. Hopefully up and running now on this Wednesday, May 13th, 2022. I'm Dave Congleton. Good to be with you. Hope you are well. As Craig gets things up and running here for us, let me run down the schedule for today. On this broadcast between now and 7 o'clock, we've got Leanne Standish from the San Luis Obispo Museum of Art checking in at 4:05, followed by a conversation with the mayor of Paso Robles, Steve Martin, where we want to talk with the mayor about the idea of a spaceport and what that means to Paso Robles. At 5:05, hometown attorney Jeff Stolberg is with us. Big victory for Stolberg and some of the folks up in San Simeon. He will explain. And then it's Wednesday. That means we're back in conversation with Dr. James Armstead for the very latest analysis on Ukraine. Sound good? Then stick around for today's edition of Hometown Radio.
When it's not always raining, there'll be days like this. When there's no one complaining, there'll be days like this. Everything falls into place like the flick of a switch. Well, my mama told me there'll be days like this.
First up on the broadcast, though, we have heard a lot about the water situation in California lately. We've heard about the drought. We've heard about the lack of rain. We've heard talk of various cities instituting some kind of water restrictions. And I suspect it's just going to get worse. But I reached out to Dr. James Papp, and this is what makes James such a great guest. Not only was he willing to tackle this subject, on a short notice, but he's here today to give us a historical perspective. Because in order to understand California, I submit, you've got to understand water. If you want to know how L.A. was formed, how San Francisco became San Francisco, how California became California, you've got to understand water and water policy. With that in mind, we welcome Dr. Papp back to the broadcast. James, good afternoon.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And my assumption is correct. Understanding California, you understand water.
Yeah. Well, I mean, human life, animal life, plant life is all based on water.
Yeah, but the historical evolution of the state.
At some times we almost had a messianic relationship with water. The notion, I mean, there was always loads of water in Northern California and not much water in Southern California. And my family has a long, odd history with water in the state, because one of the ideas with turning Southern California into a Garden of Eden from the desert it had been was bringing water down. And there was actually a novel written that was turned into a play called The Winning of Barbara Worth. Because, you know, whenever you have an issue, you have to make a plot out of it.
Sure.
And my great aunt was the first actress who played Barbara Worth. She wanted to get the movie part, but she was too old by then. I think we went to Pola Negri. So yeah, you've got this really interesting. My mother was born in Owens Mouth, a town that you probably never heard of because it's now called Canoga Park. But at the time it was founded in 1913, they had just brought Owens Valley water down to Los Angeles, and they were very thrilled about publicizing this. Fast forward a few years and you have the Owens Valley Water War, and they're not eager to publicize it.
Yeah.
And so they changed the name to Canoga Park, and nobody knows what Canoga means.
We are in the middle of a drought now, but historically, that's nothing new to California.
No. And the real problem with California is, it was founded in a period of unusually high precipitation. So we had a sort of a very green and optimistic view of how fertile California was going to be. And B, that was always very changeable. So we went through feast or famine, flood or drought. And unfortunately, a lot of our policy has been made out of crisis rather than out of planning.
I was reading a statistic today. In 1850, when we became a state, we had four times the water that we actually needed. That certainly would not be true today.
I think we had thousands of times the water that we needed because there were very few people there.
About a million.
I think the statistic you're referring to is when Los Angeles and San Francisco first started water projects, and Los Angeles had at that time four times the water that it needed. Mm. But you know, you can find all kinds of statistics, and some of them are true.
But the point I will take away is that at one point, we had far more water than we needed.
That's absolutely true, okay. Because we had, I mean, you go back to the times before the colonists arrived, and there were, you know, probably not more than a million indigenous people here, and they were hunting and gathering, and, you know, they just used the water that was to hand. And I'm sure they had droughts, and that created difficulties for them. This is true, you know, when people speculate at the disappearance of Southwestern civilizations, they often look to drought first. But once you get Westerners coming here, they want to start controlling the water, pushing the water from the place it's not needed to the place it is needed, saving the water when it's not needed till when it is needed, et cetera, et cetera.
So, for example, I read that we came to the state in 1850. Within 10 years, we'd already set up water districts and levees across the state.
Yes. And then, so that was kind of a localized effort. You know, the importance of this, even at the very, very local level, is that when you think of San Luis Obispo, we had a cholera epidemic here in 1850. How do you get cholera? You get it from water. So you're getting unclean water. The cholera epidemic only killed the Indians. They were drinking unclean water. The white settlers were drinking clean water from a different source. And so you had a population virtually wiped out. So then... another really important thing is the gold rush, because the miners, you use a lot of water in order to process gold. And the miners were very good at diverting water.
Yeah.
And so this created a whole new legal system for California, because in other places, water depended on riparian rights. Ripa is the Latin word for bank. So if your farm is next to a river or a creek or a spring, you get that water. However, the miners diverted water from great distances. So then we got this new concept of appropriative rights, which is whoever appropriates water, i.e. steals it from some other place. Which is the history of California. And this has continued so that now we're in this very peculiar situation where there are two levels of appropriative rights. People who appropriated water before 1914 when they started issuing water permits, and people who appropriated it after. Mm. And in a drought, so when there's enough water, everybody gets along. And as soon as there's a drought, everybody's rights to own water are on a great chain of being. And the ones who appropriated it before 1914, they're first in line.
Dr. James Papp, back on Hometown Radio. In the email you sent me this morning, you wrote, a quote here, California and water, it's a struggle between the rights of users versus the rights of owners.
Yes, and our legal system is really based on ownership. People are always suing each other over who owns things under common law or under written law. And the problem is that often doesn't adapt very well to current day circumstances. So... for instance, groundwater is owned. Here's still a third level of ownership of water. There's the riparian, which is whether it's next to you, the appropriative, whether you appropriated it from somewhere, and there's the overlying. So groundwater is owned by whoever owns the land on top of it. Well, that's probably a big farm. Not necessarily next to a city or down the road a city where you have millions of people who could be using it. And so being based on ownership rather than necessarily the most efficient use of water, it's been a very long, slow process to get to any kind of water justice. During a big drought in 1928, the California Constitution was amended to include that use of water had to be reasonable and beneficial. So you couldn't, even if you owned it, you couldn't just, let it flow away.
And that was a six-year drought, 1928 to 1934. Yeah. All right. Dr. James Papp, off to a great start with us on Hometown Radio today as he gives us a historical perspective on water in the state of California. We'll pick up the conversation. You're listening to AM 920, FM 96.5. This is the Dave Congleton Show. KVC News Talk Time, 3:21. Dave Congleton with historian Dr. James Papp. I asked Dr. Papp if he would engage us in a little bit of conversation about the history of California through the perspective of water. As we come back with you, Professor, I think the perfect example of what we're talking about here is the creation of Los Angeles, of modern Los Angeles, through but some people have called the rape of the Owens Valley.
Los Angeles was a dinky little place until it got water, and the whole Southland. So first you had this whole effort for the, not just the greening. I mean, originally people's notion of the Southland was that it was going to be little farms. This was always kind of the utopian notion of America. Even Thomas Jefferson imagined all of America being mile square farms, and that you wouldn't have anyone fighting because they'd all be a mile away from each other. That didn't work. So, or maybe it would have worked. Anyway, so the notion was in the 1890s. So in the 1880s, they actually hired they created a state engineer, and he produced a lot of white papers, project papers on water and what we needed to, that we really needed to engineer the state's water. And basically, it was bringing Northern California water to Southern California. Hmm. And so you had in Southern California, this notion, let's, create all these plots of land in Orange County and Imperial County, and everybody can be, little farmers there and grow grapes and grow oranges and grow what have you. This all worked very well until they built a somewhat inconsidered aqueduct from the Colorado River that during a flood broke and created the Salton Sea. And in fact, threatened to pretty much flood the entire
That's how the Salton Sea was created.
Empire. Yes.
Really? Okay.
It wasn't there before, right. Certainly not in modern times. And so they actually, the only corporation that was sort of had enough infrastructure to try and solve this problem in the Southern Pacific. And so they were recruited in order to build levees and finally get the water back in place. But then you had the Salton Sea, and that was seen at one time, it's this wonderful place that, boat. And if you ever go down to Salton Sea, it's really hideous because it's dried up and there's, it's gotten worse and worse. But you walk through all of these blocks and blocks and blocks of subdivisions that have never been built on. They had a yacht club there and so on.
Really?
And so now it's kind of a disaster. But it's sort of representative of how difficult water has been. So what we ended up with, instead of lots of little people with lots of little plots of land, which is not a very efficient means of farming, is we had lots of little people with lots of little plots of lawns and swimming pools. You ended up with the suburbs. And suburbs use up a lot of water.
Yeah.
So, in Los Angeles, so over the state of California over the last 30 years, we've managed to cut per capita water consumption by about 37%. That's going from, that's more like a 25-year figure because my figures are about 5 years too old. But going from about 250 gallons a day to about 150 gallons a day. And you probably, are sitting there and thinking, oh my, I do not use 150 gallons a day of water. I hope you don't drink that much.
Yeah.
But about half of urban water in California is used for landscaping. And so, you know, bicycling over here, I went past all of these lawns and grassy verges and trees and, you know, lovely things. But that soaks up a lot of water. Yeah. So compared to San Francisco, urban San Francisco uses about 40 gallons per day per household, not per person.
Per household.
Per household. If you want to go where the highest urban per person consumption of water is, go to the area around Palm Springs. That's where they're really, you know.
Because they're landscaping in the middle of a desert.
They're landscaping in the middle of the desert. They have golf courses. You walk down whatever the main drag is in Palm Springs, and they're spraying water at you. There's swimming pools all over the place, et cetera, et cetera. So our usage of water is based on creating an Eden where Eden was not perhaps meant to be.
Which is personified by Los Angeles.
Which is basically personified by Los Angeles. So Los Angeles, they had a guy named Mulholland and a sort of a fictionalized version of Mulholland and the water wars are...
Chinatown.
Chinatown. Lovely film.
Great film.
And, well, not a lovely film, but certainly a great film. So what they did is they quietly bought up all, they appropriated, they bought up all the water rights in the Owens Valley. So suddenly the Owens River, all that water was being diverted to Los Angeles, and all the farmers in the Owens Valley, certainly the ones who hadn't made deals, there's no water. The Owens Lake goes dry. If you drive by there, sometimes you'll see a little bit of water in it. But pretty much now that whole area up around Bishop, it's kind of it's high desert. And that's where the Japanese Americans were plopped in Manzanar. It's a pretty forbidding area that was once the fruit basket.
Who pushed for the water diversion? Who were the forces behind it?
It was basically the city fathers of Los Angeles. They were looking for water, and that's where they saw it. And so the base of the aqueduct, the end of the aqueduct, the terminus of the aqueduct, was the San Fernando Valley, and that's what Owens Mouth was named to celebrate. And then in the 1920s, so that's 1913, by the 1920s, there are farmers up in the Owens Valley who are trying to blow up the aqueduct. Yeah. And they're shooting, and there's dynamite. To call it the Owens Valley Water War is perhaps a little exaggerated, but certainly Owens Mouth decided to change its name to Canoga Park.
And we are going to go to California Headline News and ABC Radio News. Craig will update us with Time Saver Traffic and Weather together. Then we will continue our conversation with Dr. James Papp, getting a sense of water history in California. More to come. I'd stick around. You're listening to the Dave Congleton Show. We are busy on Hometown Radio. Tomorrow we have Dr. Rene Bravo giving us his perspective on this baby shortage situation. Also, author Ray McDonald. On Friday, Stu Jenkins is our next candidate in the June 7th primary. Obviously, he's running for county clerk recorder. It is a Dave Congleton Show weekday afternoons from 3:05 to 7 o'clock. We continue our conversation with historian Dr. James Papp here at my invitation to remind us that water is an important part of California history, and it is certainly not a shortage of controversy. On the Stolberg line, for you, Dr. Papp, was there not an Owens Valley water flood that killed quite a few people?
I think your listener is thinking of, it's related to Owens Valley, but it was one of the dams that Mulholland built in the Santa Clarita area, and that collapsed and killed upwards of 400 people. I can't remember if it's 415, 450, but around that number. That was, you know, at the other end of that Owens Valley water. So I think that's what you're thinking of.
I think so, too. Text number two on the Stolberg line. In the 50s and 60s, California Valley was planned and marketed to be a vacation playground, not unlike Palm Springs. No water on the east side of Valley left many with nearly useless pieces of land. It's California.
Yes.
California.
No, I don't have a car, but occasionally I go camping with my sister who does, and we drive by there. And again, you know, one of these great California sites, we're always talking about, oh, we don't have enough land, we don't have enough housing, da da da. Well, there's there's loads of surveyed plots out in the desert. They are yours for the taking.
Finally, George on the Stolberg line, if you have enough money and with a number of good lawyers, all water rights are negotiable.
I think that's a very good point, because one of the problems in our state, and I'm not sure what case is coming up that you're talking with in an hour and a half from now, but I think that it's a water rights case. Isn't
yes,
it?
In a way, yeah. Yes.
So that will be, you know, spend your whole afternoon here, folks. Find out everything about water. Yeah. But, you know, in a sense, one of the problems we have is a whole bunch of layers of laws about water dating really back to Spanish times. I mean, there's still Pueblo rights to water that are part of our water laws. And so it's kind of a question of battling over rules that may no longer be relevant and are certainly not necessarily just in their distribution of water.
So it's all about court battles and stealing water.
A lot of it is about court battles.
Who's got the water? They've got the power.
And secret negotiations and this and that. So, here's an interesting statistic. So just to help you break it down. About half of water in California is never really collected for anything. It is the water that flows through rivers unimpeded, wild and scenic, as they are referred to under law. And this was something that was really codified in the late 60s and early 70s when people were interested in the environment, finally. The other half of the water is collected and used in, and that water, 80% of it goes to agriculture, and 20% of it goes to urban use. Now, that 80% that goes to agriculture, how big a part of our California state product, like our GDP for California, is agriculture? It's 2%.
2%.
Using 80% of the water. Now, for agricultural areas like San Luis Obispo, it's a bit more. In San Luis Obispo, it's 7%. But agriculture used to be much, much bigger. You can see, and of course, water is absolutely necessary for agriculture. And so you can see why so much... because it's under their ground, or they have riparian rights, or they have appropriative rights over it that go back long before 1914. So they have it. And so the cities are struggling for it. And it's fine when it's wet. Nobody fights.
All right, when you have plenty of it, only when there's a shortage.
When you have a drought, suddenly there is a pecking order of who gets it first.
Dr. James Papp back on this broadcast. So L.A. was essentially created because we took a desert, turned it into what it is today by diverting water. I'm going to be diplomatic and say we diverted the water. I want to make sure we have time to talk about Hetch Hetchy, because I'm not as familiar with that story. But that explains San Francisco.
Yeah. So Southern California is getting its water from both the Colorado River. That goes down to San Diego. And as a native San Diegan, I can tell you by the time it gets there, it really tastes bad. I always remember coming back from New York when I lived there, which has fantastic water, and taking my first glass of San Diego water and wanting to spit it out. LA has pretty decent water and from the Owens Valley. San Francisco and Los Angeles were arranging their water at about the same time. And the arrangement, and that's kind of that 1914 date of pre and post for permits. That is because of those two cities trying to get a hold of the water they needed. And so what they did in San Francisco is they dammed Hetch Hetchy, which had been this beautiful valley, part of Yosemite, federal land, and filled it up with water, and that is their reservoir. And San Franciscans have been resistant to giving that up.
And didn't John Muir lead the fight against that?
He did indeed. Mm. And during the Reagan administration, I can't remember the name of the Interior Secretary who said...
James Watt?
No, it wasn't Watt. It was another guy who's still around, I think. Hmm. But he wanted to reconsider Hetch Hetchy and turning it back into natural area. And Dianne Feinstein was very much against it because she's been around forever, as we know. But she sort of made fun of it and said, oh, well, you know, give up all that water just for another campground. Well, that kind of brings up the notion of water and social justice. Who gets the water? Because in a way you could say, well, campgrounds, sure. Campgrounds are mostly used by, you know, middle-class white people. They, you know, if you don't have a car, I can attest to you now, you don't use campgrounds for the most. You don't go up to Yosemite because it's a big pain. But now San Francisco has become an almost purely, well, I mean, all the black people have disappeared from San Francisco because they've been priced out. So, you know, it's kind of a fight between two groups of bourgeois people. Who gets the water, the campers or the people in the city? It also ties into...
Before you explain that, how did Hetch Hetchy change San Francisco, though? Having access to that water,
it allowed them to expand and to have pretty much the thing about reservoirs is it allows you to have a constant and reliable supply of water. And here's another interesting thing that actually ties into San Luis Obispo. Why did we have a Morro Bay power plant? Well, we were big into hydroelectric power in the early 20th century, and whoops, a drought hit. And that was around 1913, 1914 as well. And so everybody said, not only do we not have anything to drink, but we don't have any electricity. So we have to make different kinds of power plants, and that's why they made Morro Bay.
Let's take a call. We've got Eric on KVEC. Hi, Eric.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hi, Eric.
Hi there, Eric.
Hi. I wanted to make a couple quick corrections that I've heard today.
Oh, good.
And the first one would be... You know, all water rights are negotiable. That is, unless you're a farmer, they just take your water rights. And some of them have gone back over 100 years, and they forfeit them to give them to cities. And that's been happening for years in California. They just take the water rights. Your piece of paper doesn't mean anything to the state of California. So not that they're all negotiable. California takes them away from farmers constantly. But in the percentage... as you gave, 50% of the water, at least 50% of the water goes to the environment.
Yes.
At least. And it will always be that way. Even if all we have is 50%, it goes to the environment. Now, the 80% of the 50%, the other 50%, so we'll say the 40%, it goes to the farmers only when it's available. So that 80% or 40%, whatever you want to call it, could be nothing. It could be 10%. It could be 5%. There's no guarantee to the farmer to get that 40% only on a good year when water's plentiful. The rest of the 20%, as much as possible, will always be given to the constituents, basically. So there is a little flaw because farmers, you know, get blamed for that 80% all the time. They only get it when water's plentiful.
Yeah, you make an excellent point. These are paper rights.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I hear that statistic, and over the last few years, that statistic is definitely nowhere close to being true.
All right.
So,
Thank you, Eric.
That's all I was saying.
I'm glad you called. Thank you.
Yeah, and Eric brings up a very important point, I think. For two reasons. One, that, again, everybody fights over these things when there's a shortage, and who has the right? Does the farmer have the first right? Does the, you know, the big agribusiness versus the small farmer? Does the city? But the other thing, of course, is it's not just that all of this water goes to the farmer and then disappears. You, the consumer... live off of that stuff that the farmer grows.
Yeah.
And so, you know, a gallon of milk takes maybe 600 gallons of water to make it possible.
Suzanne's with us on KVEC. Hi, Suzanne.
Well, good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hi, Suzanne.
Fascinating guest. Fascinating.
Oh, thank you. We may have to bring him back.
I wanted to comment. I had a couple mortgages and a couple titles, and I just read them because I was bored. But what I didn't know is they had mineral rights. So when I moved here to SLO, I was telling old-timers, yeah, they have mineral rights. She goes, they got water rights, and we have 15 acres. I go, no. She goes, had land 50 years, 55 years, and the other old-timer said, yeah, I'll show you the letters. And the 15 acres carried the property. It wasn't used for farming. It was residential. And they go, we get letters from time to time saying, if we need to tap in your well, we will. Mm. That blew me away. It's just, I wasn't aware.
Hang on, so Suzanne.
Water.
Hang on, James.
Water must be a real big issue out here.
Yeah, no, I think that it often is funny for suburbanites to think about that. A sort of a anecdote in the opposite direction is my brother-in-law and sister down in Poway decided to drill a well, and they hit water, discovered it didn't belong to them. So they were paying the city for the water that they were pulling up through the well that they had dug. So
I'm going to let you go. I want to hear the program.
All right, Suzanne, thank you. Anything else to the story?
No, just, you know, check who owns the water first. Groundwater, riparian water, Pueblo water, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, the least that we can say is California has an extremely Byzantine water system.
All right, we'll be back for a final segment, Dr. James Papp. But first, we have been excited all week because we are beginning a new relationship with a new sponsor. We've been officially welcoming Brian Terezi and the folks at Eto Pasta up in Paso Robles to Hometown Radio. You know where Brian is right now? Right now, he is on a plane. He's flying to Italy. He's going to be there for 10 days. It's not his first time there. Brian has a love affair with Italy. He has a love affair with pasta. He knows pasta. You need to go to the Eto Marketplace in Tin City. Why? Because you're going to find on sale all sorts of pasta, along with imported specialty foods, cheeses, sauces, fine Italian wines, even single-serving desserts like my favorite, the tiramisu. Don't settle for all this other stuff. Get the finest American craft pasta, known for its flavor, nutrition, and texture. When you have a moment, Google Eto, E-T-T-O, pasta, for more information. We're so glad to have Brian and the gang on board. We welcome Eto to Hometown Radio. Leanne Standish from the San Luis Obispo Museum of Art joins us after news at the top of the hour. We're in our final segment with historian Dr. James Papp, talking about the history of water and the state of California. If you want in on the conversation with a question or comment, we would need to hear from you now, please. 805-543-8830. But Dr. Papp, since you are a historian and history repeats itself, what does the past portend for the future with water in California?
Well, I think, first of all, that the past was very much flood and drought. And it's an interesting to return to San Luis Obispo. San Luis Obispo had a ranching economy for much of the Spanish era, the whole Mexican era, and the early American era. And the problem was that you got suddenly these huge droughts that were either local or statewide. And just to give you an example, the Hollisters brought a whole bunch of sheep to California in the 1860s. That was their claim to fame before the stupid T-shirts say Hollister on them, and which have nothing to do with them. They managed barely to survive because sheep have less were able to survive on less water than cattle. Also, they sheared their sheep before the drought came. But that particular drought in Santa Barbara County, 97% of the cattle died. They were cutting down oak trees to get forage for the cattle. So if we wait until a crisis, we're always going to be blindsided, making wrong decisions. What happened in San Luis Obispo, the reason we have the Madonna Inn and lots of Swiss Italians here is because, and Danes and so on, is because we switched from a ranching industry to a dairy industry, to by and large. So the cattle had just sort of wandered around. If there was no water, they died. Because you have to milk the cows twice a day, you keep them near a water source. Mm. And so that changed. But as we're looking at the future of global warming and general warming and then climate changing in very dramatic ways back and forth, you've got to wonder, does it make sense to drink a glass of milk that has taken 400 glasses of water or 600 glasses of water to make it possible, or just to drink that glass of water?
What's the equivalency there?
You read lots of different figures, right, and 600 to 1 seems to be the reliable one, as far as I can tell. But if your listeners want, if the dairy farmers want to call up and disagree with that, you'll see as low as 4, but that doesn't make any sense. Yeah. And it's 400 to 1 for almond milk, and it's quite a bit better for oat milk. But, you know, have a glass of water or put a glass of water on your CO. I will say, as someone who one winter was renovating an old house in Poughkeepsie, New York, where it was freezing, and I didn't have any heat source in my house, if you bathe with cold water, I will tell you, you don't use much of it.
Yeah.
So, you know, on the one hand, we really need to start thinking about our use of water. There was an interesting case in front of the Coastal Commission a couple of weeks ago, I think, where they turned down a desalination plant, and everybody, you know, made fun of, oh, California turning down a desalination plant. But, you know, it was pointed out, merely through conservation, through this highly energy inefficient desalination plant, we could make the same savings.
But is there a history in the state of California of any kind of mandatory water controls?
We do quotas.
Yeah,
we do periodically, you know, tell everybody to cut back by such and such percent. What always bothers me about that is that if you're living in Beverly Hills and have 12 swimming pools and, you know, an acre of lush gardens, and then you're cutting back by 15%. What about the person in East LA who's also cutting back by 15%? Or the people who are out in these communities in the Central Valley who are getting water trucked in, or have, you know, no water at all. So, yeah, the rich always get more of everything, but we always like to look at sort of percentage cutbacks rather than actual rationing. And I think it makes sense for us to think about how we think about water.
What's been the role of the Browns, Pat Brown and Jerry Brown as governors?
Periodic, they keep coming back. Jerry Brown, just because he was here so long, he was around when there was a big fight over, it was Prop 9 back in the 1980s, over the peripheral canal. And that ended up, this is why it's so confusing in California, that ended up being a big fight between North and South and between some farmers and other farmers. And
let's squeeze in a call. We got Mike in Los Osos. Hi, Mike.
And your water issue.
Hi, Mike.
How's everybody doing?
We're good. What's up?
Okay. I was just calling about this water. So my question is, when I hike out in the mountains and I get cleared up on top, you're talking about global warming and changing, clear up on top of the mountains, like out in Santa Rita, you got a stream that was on top of the mountains at one time. So, I mean, this global, I mean, the water and stuff, I mean, the earth changes all the time, right? Correct? I mean,
it does. And it's now changing faster.
And another thing is, how does the water get out of the atmosphere? It can never really leave.
Well, I mean, you have rain. The problem with global warming is its uncertainty. So first of all, if you listened earlier in the program, California was settled at a period of historically high rainfall in the 19th and part of the 20th century. And now we're going out of that period of high rainfall. But as well with global warming, you've got it's more the chaos of changing the climate is we can no longer depend as well on regular infusion of snow and of rain. We have, you're either getting a bigger droughts and bigger floods. That's the real problem. So you can't count on them. And it's really, really expensive to store water.
And the real problem is we're out of time. All right, Mike, thanks for the call. Another nice discussion with Dr. James Papp, who gets 45 seconds for a final thought on the history of water in California.
Oh, geez. Thank you for having me. You know, don't worry about, I mean, I think it's stupid when you know, there's a drought and they take table water out of restaurants. I mean, it's not addressing the problem at all. It's theatrics. But it is something that reminds us that we do need to think about how we efficiently use water in our society, because we need to distribute it equally so everybody has a chance at it. And without it, we die.
Craig has discovered that almond milk requires 17 times more water than dairy.
That is not true. But we can argue about that off air.
All right, fair enough. All right, Dr. Papp, thank you. Off we go. We've got news and traffic and weather. Leanne Standish standing by to join us next. You're listening to the Dave Congleton Show.